Good evening, everyone. Hear me okay in the back? Quite happy to be with you this evening. And first thing that I wanted to acknowledge is even though what I would call speed dating during our individual meetings had a measure of stress in it, trying to stay on time and knowing that partly because of that, maybe not being completely settled and as responsive as I would like, I was still and have been over the last couple days, once again, very touched by you individually and by what gives me an ongoing sense, and this is where you actually support my ongoing ministry, you could say, where you become part of the river of Dharma, is that when I see you after several days of practice, you look beautiful to me. And I see in you, I see your beingness with a little bit of space from your usual preoccupations, a little bit of organic removal of the thorns, which of course, Aaron shared with us last night that this is the metaphor that the Buddha used, that there really are no thorns. I hear something going on with the... something in the line. Okay. That does it. That it doesn't take as much as we think. As Sylvia Boorstein, one of my colleagues and friends, entitled a whole book on Dharma, saying it's easier than you think. And that's a different view. Because there is the view that it's harder than you think. And there are hard things that we have to face, and there's no denying that. But you can see, even after a few days, given the conditions here, where your mind is, for moments at least, free of its usual preoccupations. You can start to see the discontinuity of your thorns. Where are all your thorns now? This idea of a thorn is part of the trance, you could say, of the view of ourselves as having thorns to remove. What the Buddha called the view of ourself, sakkaya ditti. That we ultimately, that view of ourselves, we actually don't find it so much on present evidence. And that's why, as we use this very loving and gentle tool, even using the feeling of the thorns as they present themselves in our hearts and minds, slowly, slowly, we, as one teacher I love, Nisargadatta, says, we brush the dust of memory, and the natural clarity of our mind starts to shine through. And I saw that in the meetings. And the other thing that gives me so much confidence is then there's something about our faces that change. There's a joke that we all, if you come to a retreat, you get a Vipassana facelift, you know. You lose a few years. And it's all because we remove our cherished, frequent places where we innocently dwell in our minds that have been born of the struggle to accommodate experiences that we've had in our lives, the identities that we've been born into, the race that we've been born into, the religion we've been born, all these things that we've been born into that are part of our history, part of our historical self. The effects of all of that brings us to this place of tension and heavy-heartedness and grief and just living life. But just applying bare attention, clear comprehension, kindness, moment by moment, we start to see that version of ourselves that we often live out of, our view of ourselves, it takes breaks. And when it takes breaks, the light by which we see them starts to wax a little brighter. And we start to make a very gradual shift from being just carried along by that stream of distress to noticing it. Instead of relating from our thorns, we relate to them. That we take the seat of the Buddha, the one who knows, the one who's awake, noticing the Dharma, experiencing the Dharma. And consequently, I love the poet, the ecstatic Sufi poet Hafez. He says, I know that the voice of depression calls to you. I know that those voices that can ruin your life still send their invitations. But you're with the friend now. He calls it the friend. That one, that in you that can pay attention, that can notice. That is, amazingly enough, it's not something we create. It's what's here when we're not caught. This kind of what some would call a primordial awareness, this fundamental sense of ourselves, being aware. Try to stop being aware for a moment. What do we find? We find this very real-time experience of ourselves, not the historical version of ourselves. We experience ourselves momentarily free of being caught up, bound up in the story of ourselves. And what do you experience? What happens after your last thought of yourself has stopped and before the next one comes? What is it that you experience? Anybody willing to say? Now.
Freedom.
Anything else?
Emptiness.
What else?
Peace.
How far did you have to travel for that one? The pure land itself is near. So that same poem from Hafez, where he talks about the voice of depression and the invitations that can ruin your life, keep sending their, or whatever it is that can ruin your life, send your invitation. He says, you're with a friend now, and you can stay that way and even bloom. He says, keep squeezing drops of the sun. And that's, in a sense, what we're doing here. What we're getting used to is being able to trust actual reality. You know, we talk about reality. I know I've said this a few times. We talk about reality. And reality is not necessarily the version of you that lives in your mind. The version of the world that lives in your mind. Reality is actually a little bit more safe. Not initially, because it's so, the Tibetans say the reason we don't actually appreciate what it's like here and know that we don't have to even travel for it, that it's our natural state to be aware here, to be a Buddha. The reason we don't appreciate it, besides all the, I'll get into how it is we innocently leave here. But at least in the Tibetan tradition, they say there's basically four faults that we have in our way of experiencing our life. The first one is, again, this may not fall into your usual understanding of the word fault, but four reasons why we don't remember where we are and what we are in real time. Why we don't step out of the historical version of ourselves. Because this is too close. It's too close. It's too vast. It doesn't fit into our usual conceptual framework. Can't put it in a little box. It's too wondrous. And it's too easy. We can't believe that we just have to be awake to the presently arising experience. What the Buddha called one fortunate attachment. All day long I felt this afternoon when I was once again noodling about this evening's talk, I kept being revisited by that quote that I shared the other night, that about you need the past and thoughts to suffer. You don't need anything to be free. The boulders of the past rest on your chest and impede your life and freedom. What's the beginning of? I forgot the rest, but nevertheless. But another poem of a similar vein kept coming into my mind. And it was, again, from that poet Hafez, where he says, what do people who are sad have in common? It seems they have all built a shrine to the past and often go there to do a strange wail and worship. What's the beginning of happiness? It's to stop being so religious like that. I wrote a second verse. What do people who are anxious and worried have in common? It seems they have all built a shrine to the future, the imagined future, and often go there to do a strange wail and worship. What's the beginning of happiness? It's to stop being so religious like that. So we rail against religious views, being attached to views, being attached to rituals, being attached to customs, being rigid in our beliefs. But that religiosity lives a little bit closer than we sometimes want to admit. And because of the mistaken devotion to a future that never arrives, into a past that's gone, that only exists as the presently arising heartache or grief or whatever, or memory, everything lives here. But because of this very strong tendency to literally live in the imagined past and future, we deprive ourselves of the openness. Somebody said empty, peace, freedom that waits. So you've done a lot already. This room is literally pregnant with that sense of quiet, empty, peace. And your mind is free enough of its usual preoccupations to sense that. So celebrate for a moment. Where are all the thorns now? If you don't consult your memory. So it's easy to talk about this. But we are all, as a Tibetan teacher named Dujum Rinpoche put it, he says, isn't it true that after your last thought has passed and before the next one comes, isn't there a vivid clarity with nothing particular to see? Just clarity. He says, this is awareness. But isn't it also true that a thought suddenly arises? And if that thought is noticed, as we've been encouraging us to create the conditions to be able to notice each presently arising experience, treating thoughts just as we would a sound, just as we would a taste or a smell, just a natural sense experience, an expression, you could say, of that vivid clarity, an expression of awareness, as everything is. So if we're able to notice that thought, it's just an expression. But if it goes unnoticed, that thought spreads out into ordinary thinking. And this he called the chain of delusion. Because in that moment where mindfulness doesn't rise up to notice the thought, the chain of delusion starts. In that little chain of thoughts that happens so fast and so innocently, we are literally born into the imagined version of ourselves. Someone who, a version of ourselves, somebody that actually doesn't exist. A kind of virtual me. Where is that version right now? Now, when I say that, it's so obvious that you're here. And one of the things that just comes through in that, in the interviews, that's why it feels like such a privilege and such a blessing, is what's here is that unique expression of life, how life has forged you individually through all these non-personal experiences that we are all part of. This is part of the understanding of emptiness. You are not different. You're not the same, nor are you different from everything that you have come from. As Nagarjuna, person considered kind of the founder of Mahayana Buddhism, he says, you're neither severed from, nor are you forever fused with those conditions. This is the deathless teaching for Buddhas who care for the world. Whenever we get into that version of ourselves where we think I'm completely apart from the flow of life, I'm separate individual, this is the other part of the version that plays. That version, which is really a story of ourselves, that's the internal narrative. In that version, I, and it's a nice way to be able to talk about my life, it's true in a conventional sense, but I've come from the past, and I'm passing through here on my way to the future, where I will either get what I want or get rid of what I don't want, or I'll get older or die if I'm, I'll get older if I'm lucky, and I'll die eventually. That's the conceptual version of myself. That version of myself completely disappears in real time. And if I live entirely in that version of myself, that version of Sakkaya Ditti, self-view, because that version is tethered or bound in time, it's linear in a way. It's very small. It's very confined. And it associates relief, liberation, home, love, everything with how things turn out. And time is, in that version, time is running out. And that version is also very much tied to this body, the identity with our body, what in many traditions is considered the deepest identity that we have. Yet identification with the body is, as we find, as we practice, is a little bit more optional than we think. But if long as my identity is bound into the body's doing its own thing. It's one of the things that the Buddha recognized when he sat and didn't get up. He saw that everything, nothing whatsoever in this body could be held on to, could be clung to as I or mine. He couldn't even find an I or me or mine in the body. All he could find was these ever-changing streams of elemental experience, sensations, which are completely non-personal. And yet this story that plays in our mind, the version of ourself that plays in our mind, I hope this doesn't make you too squeamish, but if it does, that's okay. Maybe there's a, if I have it with me, there's a kind of accessible understanding of this that we can find in science, in the study of the human body. That this little list of this factoid list was a very eye-opening. I'll just read some of them to you. Humans spend a third of their lives sleeping. Each person has a unique tongue print. There's enough iron in the human body to make one small nail. A cough releases an explosive charge of air that moves up to 60 miles per hour. Sneezes travel over 100 miles per hour. It takes 17 muscles to smile, 43 to frown. It takes approximately 200,000 frowns to create one permanent brow line. Most people blink about 25 times a minute and about 20,000 times a day. The average person speaks about 31,500 words per day. Every breath we inhale, billions of atoms that end up as heart cells, kidney cells, brain cells, The average adult is made up of 100 trillion cells. If you unwound and joined the DNA from the genes of the cells, it would fit in an ice cube. The string would stretch 80 billion miles. That's from the Earth to the Sun and back 400 times. The body gives birth to 100 billion red cells every day. Every square inch of the body is populated by 32 million bacteria that are born and die in it. This one's gross, kind of. Humans shed 600,000 particles of skin every hour, about 1.5 pounds a year. By 70, an average person will lose 105 pounds of skin. Most dust particles in your home are made from dead skin. Just a few more. The body makes a new stomach lining every 5 days. Body makes a new liver every 6 weeks. Replaces new head hair every 2 to 5 years. Body replaces new eyebrows that consist of 450 hairs every 3 to 5 months. Grows new skin once a month. Body replaces with new skeleton every 7 years. 15,000 cells of your body will die and be replaced with new cells, all while you listen to this sentence. So in other words, at any given moment, the parts of the body are appearing and disappearing. So if you think you are your physical body, which body are you talking about? Again, part of the innocence of our perception and then the identity view that we have with our bodies, part of that version of ourselves that plays in our mind, the conventional view, is because typically, the proximity of our observation of this body, and this is a very important element in the discovery of the Buddha, that there, every little moment there, in every moment's experience, there's just a moment of contact. It's very simple. There's a little feeling. There's perception. That's based on memory, what something is. There's maybe thoughts about it, mental formations, mental factors, and then there's consciousness. And all five of those little things are popping up and vanishing in every instant. We call that, because of the proximity of our usual observation, we call that self. But if we look at what's happening actually moment to moment, we don't find any. And the same is true when the body is put under a microscope. From a distance, it seems solid. And that's perception. Perception depends on where you're looking from. And if you get close to the body, you put it under a microscope, if you turn up the power high enough, you don't find any body. You find space. You find the same space that lives inside of you and lives inside of me, and we find that there is, in that, we don't find any you, any me, or any self at all. There's just what there is. It's all here, but not as it appears. Yet, conventionally speaking, from the very useful and appropriate, more gross or conventional level of perception, the domain of compassion, the domain of stress and suffering, this is all very real, and we are. I'm very uniquely individual, and my story about myself comes to me because of everything that's happened. But that story of me, that identity, that view, the composite, doesn't really capture what it's like after my last idea of myself and before the next one comes. It often clouds the natural freedom and ease that is just waiting while we're looking for something else. So the beauty of a retreat, on one hand, is that we can see the discontinuity of our personality views, our views of ourself, and get used to maybe not being so dependent on it. You know, the idea of not being who we think we are is terrifying. But the reality of it, I think it's our happiest moments. It's our most peaceful moments. When we realize there really is no, on present evidence, in real time, there is no thorn. This is in no way to minimize how much stress and suffering we experience and have experienced. And how essential and rich and beautiful our stories are. In fact, there was somebody in the group says, I want to hear people's stories, and I want to hear your story too. But I think more importantly, and where the Buddha put his attention, is to give you the opportunity to recognize an element of your nature that is completely not limited to that story. And so that you can then turn and relate to the version of yourself that plays in your mind. The one that, where you're good, where you're better, where you're best, whether you're good enough, not good enough, too much. I think we've all alluded to that comparing mind, that one of the fetters of our mind, where we could relate to that, where we can see that any idea of self that is not recognized as just a functional expression of our life. I know that I am sitting here and I'm functioning in the role of, tonight I'm the, as Bonnie Duran says, I'm the sage on the stage. That's my identity. But you know, I go home. And if I start showing up at home as the sage on the stage, how annoying. And my daughter, she doesn't care. She won't even say good morning. I said to her, it's actually been a couple years, but I said to her, you know, it's nice to say good morning. She's now 20. This was when she was still in her teens. It's nice to say good morning. She says, nobody does that anymore. But any sense of special inflation, any identity is so fragile and so reliable, and especially if we tether it to our body, what could be more fragile? Our moods, what could be more ever-changing? To our thoughts, one day I feel like I'm the sage on the stage, and the next I'm just terrified. So to be able to relate to our view, our self views, even to the view, even the views of our suffering, it can become a religious conviction. Someone today told me, who I spoke to, who was not on the retreat, had to take care of some business, told me to tell this story, and I tend to sometimes put stories in storage because I over tell them, but this one I think may be useful in this context. I was at I went to visit a teacher in India. I mentioned the teacher the other night, the same teacher that said you need the past and thoughts to suffer. His name is H.W.L. Punja. And I traveled to India with just on fire to meet him. Maybe I'll tell two stories about it, but this was the one that she remembered. But when I arrived, I had this very profound interaction with him, but then I got deathly ill. Not so deathly ill, but I really was delirious and not happy. Everything was discharging, and I was staying in a guest house across the Ganges River in Hardwar. And eventually I felt well enough after he, for some strange reason, sent me big chunks of cheese that I started eating. I could never figure out why he sent me cheese. But anyway, I ate enough cheese, and I was able to make my way to the kuti, the house where he was holding what they call satsang, where he sits with people and takes their questions and starts dialoguing. And you feel the presence of someone who is generally free of their usual preoccupations. And it's in all traditions, there's some version of when you are. And everyone has access to this when we're free of our preoccupations. Our mind becomes really quiet for a little bit. And if you stay in that quiet and you don't disturb it, you discover that it's just permeated with this brightness, this light that you've never known, but you recognize it at once. That's home. That's me. Not the idea of me, but a much more immediate sense of being what could be described as the natural happiness of being awake, of being conscious. But anyway, so he had that kind of power about him, a kind of presence. But I had to kind of drag my body along the Ganges and then across the river, and then I got to the little street where the teacher was meeting with people, and I was just kind of miserable. And I saw that there was a little cellar of bananas, and I bought some bananas, and everything seemed very intense to me, and a monkey jumped out of a tree and stole my bananas. And just, you know, overwhelmed. And then I finally made my way to the teacher's place. I had to walk up a flight of stairs, and he greeted me, and he said to me, he welcomed me back, and he said, how are you doing? How are you feeling? And I said, I'm much better, but I'm still sick. And he looked at me really intently, and he said, where is sick? And I don't know how that sounds to you, but in that moment, I couldn't find sick. Still some symptoms, but with the absence of that, what I realized at that moment, I had completely incarnated as sick. Now, many of us that have chronic illnesses, it's really easy to have that define our lives. And it's a little bit more challenging. But it was so interesting, the moment that that identity of sick melted away, huge surge of vitality. And it dawned on me that identity, even though it approximates the symptoms that I was experiencing, as an identity, it was more monolithic, it was more solid, and it was depressing to my vital energy. And I say this because many of us have similar cherished views of ourself that put weight on our hearts. And what we try to do is see that for what it is, relate to it, wake up out of it, which is what we do very gradually. We pull those thorns out through just experiencing ourselves more and more and more on present evidence, what we actually experience. And in that way, each of us can begin to see the difference between what we actually experience and the version of ourselves playing in our mind. Or as the wonderful founder of the Audubon Society put it, if there is a difference between the bird and what the field guidebook says, believe the bird. It's really easy to start to bow to the shrine of the field guidebook, even though we never find it on present evidence. That's why this is so relieving. But as I was saying before, it's a very innocent process of how it is that we go from this natural openness that you are recovering, there's no doubt. How we go from that, and how that chain of delusion, how we just slide into ordinary thinking and then believe the field guidebook. And it's in reaction, and why it's so important to begin to catch when we can, not turn it into another religion, but to catch it when something is pleasant, just really feel the pleasantness of it. When something is unpleasant, learn how to accommodate the unpleasant. Because the pleasant, reacted to with liking and wanting, creates a lot of pressure. The unpleasant, I talked to the other night about the Vipassana romance. I didn't talk about the Vipassana vendetta. Where something triggers an unpleasant feeling and not liking, and then pressure, and then out of that pressure of not liking and of aversion, attention, then there's the kind of compulsion to strategize, to think, and to make that person the secret to my misery. You're the reason for my misery, and it's the cause of projection, it's the cause of war. All because we have not known how to accommodate the unpleasant. And the strength of our attention, the growing continuity of mindfulness, begins to give us a little bit more of the resilience to be able to open to our pain, which people have been doing. And that's another thing that's so beautiful to watch and to be with. But it's often more subtle and insidious how it is that we go from my version would be just the essential howiness and the Victorianess and the Aaronness and all of you, the pegginess. You have such pegginess. And we've never had a conversation, but you just emanate pegginess. And I have a feeling because you have brushed the dust of memory a lot. You let yourself be. Freedom. I may be projecting it on you. But nevertheless, all of us have our, whatever your name is, you have a kind of essence in a way. That unique individuality, that unique expression of life, that in the version that plays in your mind is somehow not quite right. But what happens when you don't consult your memory? Where's the not quite right in real time? But we are so habituated to the not quite right that it becomes the lens through which we live our lives. And it deprives us of our freedom, that unbinding. One of the most poignant experiences of this, one that we can actually maybe relate to some version in our own life. Same daughter Molly, who in her early teenage years, didn't give me the time of day, as I was saying. When she was 3, and the reason I think I said that throughout the years in bios that where I talk about her, I called her my guru, my new guru. When she was 3, she went off to nursery school. And she had these little brown-haired ringlet curls, very cherubic, kind of like the Gerber baby. Just perfect expression of life, perfect Molliness. And then a few days after she went to nursery school the first time, we saw her in front of the mirror. And she was pulling on her hair, trying to straighten her hair because there were these, a pair of blonde, straight hair, blue-eyed twins who had, who she began to compare herself to. And we saw her in front of the mirror pulling on her hair. Broke my heart. That was the beginning of not quite right. And then that view of herself as other gets reinforced. And then because it's never a view of self is not ourselves, and it's just a thought, and so it's inherently insecure. That's why all of us, if we're anything but kind and merciful to ourselves, because we are so fragile, because we've built a house of self on an idea of not quite right. Not on our essential Molliness. So it was really poignant. And it's actually helped me to see how all of us have some version of how there's a difference between the bird and the field guidebook. And this is a real opportunity that you have taken to be the bird. To be the Buddha. From Kala Rinpoche, Tibetan teacher. There's nothing to be gained, nothing to be found that is not there already. Truth is so simple. Buddhahood is so simple, so self-evident. Truth is here, even in this very room. Truth is you. The supreme silence, infinity is in you. You are the silence. You are the truth. You are the Buddha. It's here in this very moment, so simple and unaffected, so near. Yet we make it so distant when it's so near. So remote when it's so immediate, so complicated when it's so simple. Do you know what it's like to be at the roadside with your car, but to have lost the way? You are the Buddha. Then why don't you feel it? Why don't you know it utterly through and through? Because there's a veil in the way, which is attached to appearances such as the belief that you are not the Buddha, that you are a separate individual. If you can't lift this veil at once, then it must be dissolved gradually. If you've seen through it totally, even one glimpse, then you can see through it all the time, wherever you are, whatever presents itself, however things seem to be, simply refer to that ever-present wakefulness, spaciousness, and clarity. Or as Ajahn Chah, who's very important to the lineage of teachers here and practice here, said about this mind, truth is there's really nothing wrong with it. It's intrinsically pure. Within itself, it's already peaceful. That the mind is not peaceful is because it follows moods. The real mind doesn't have anything to it. It's simply an aspect of nature. It becomes peaceful or agitated because moods deceive it. But really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful. Just like a leaf which is still so long as no wind blows. Our practice is to see this original mind. So we must train our attention to know the different sense impressions, to know the version of ourselves that plays in our mind, and not get lost in them. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice that we put ourselves through. I think I'll end with a brief poem often read from Derek Walcott from his book of poems called Sea Grapes, called Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who is yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. Thank you for your attention. Enjoy the feast of walking, and then we'll sit again with some chanting. And we wanted to let you know tonight that a sign-up list has been posted for some one-on-one meetings tomorrow for only some of you. There will be eight slots for each of us. That's 24 total. And we'd like you to consider whether you really need or want to connect. Just consider before you sign up whether it feels really important to meet and to speak about your practice, and feel free, but also consider it so that we make sure that those who need it the most or want it the most. I don't know how to say that. Anyway. They are posted now, so to let you know. And sorry that we can't meet with everybody tomorrow, but that's how it is. So please continue. Thank you.